Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcasts. This is podcast 717, which is a continuation of the podcast basically describing the toss-up races in the U.S. Congress in 2018. Why did I do two podcasts for this? I have a rule. I don't like to do hour and a half long podcasts. I like to keep them roughly 30 minutes. And I think that way you can listen to the first one, take a little break, do something else. Two or three days later, you can go back to the second one, listen to that, and you'll have the same baseline for the 2018 congressional midterms as I have. And then when something changes, we can revisit it and we don't have to do two podcasts. So that's part of the reason. These two podcasts basically form a baseline for looking at House of Representative races in 2018. Because to be quite honest with you, people are saying ridiculous things. They're making ridiculous predictions about what's going to happen. And, you know, I will probably do a whole podcast about that at some point. Because you really have to be careful because today, whether it's the right or the left, the people that are doing analysis and the people that are talking about stuff are really exhorted to take a point of view. And even someone like Charlie Cook, who does the Cook Political Report, is put in a position when he's on these shows to say outrageous things so that – or Larry Sabato is another one who makes these statements. And, you know, there is – a mountain of data available in all these districts. And so when you're talking about 435 districts, it's impossible in a soundbite to lay out what's really happening. The best that I can do, and I did this, I went through every one of these toss-up races. I haven't gone through all the races, but there's no point in doing, you know, these districts in, West Texas that are 100, you know, that are plus 36 Republican districts. You concentrate on the toss-up races. And then if that changes, then you can outline a couple of races, say, well, now this was happening in this district and it's changed. I did it because I wanted to know what's going on, and I'm sharing that with you. Well, before I get into these races, I should say east of the Mississippi River, or as Art Bell used to say, east of the Rockies. Let's talk about a great company that I'm working with. If you are in business, especially if you are a small business, listen up, because this message is for you. If you're a developer and you develop websites for clients that are doing anything, whether it's back office or if they're doing any e-commerce or if they want to get paid, here's the thing about having a great payment processor. You will get paid faster. It's great for cash flow, and it's a service to offer clients. And, you know, there's all kinds of issues. Like with credit card payments, you want to save money. You want good rates. You want a processor that can work with different systems. And this is all about what ReliaFund is. ReliaFund is a payment processor that has been providing integrated solutions to get payments cleared for more than two decades. They work with other payment processors. That tells you a little bit about their deal. If you're developing an e-commerce website, you developers, the fact is these guys will answer a phone. If you deal with actual human beings, it's always better. And so this is what ReliaFund is all about. Here's the deal. No long-term contracts. They're secure. They're technology focused, they're flexible, and they know their stuff. 866-243-5040. You'll talk to Kevin Hill or Greg Lowry, or you can check them out at ReliaFund.com, R-E-L-I-A-F-U-N-D, ReliaFund.com. I'll be telling you more about ReliaFund in the future. I use them. I've got a ReliaFund button on my website, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in the future. ReliaFund at ReliaFund.com, or click on the banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcasts.com. Thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast on Stitcher.com, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Google Play, lots of the Spreaker, a lot of these places that syndicate with the Bob Davis Podcast. And I want to tell you about TuneIn. So if you have Alexa, and you can now have it work with TuneIn to ask Alexa for the Bob Davis Podcast, and she will go find them and play them. And I'll tell you more about that because I have to read a little bit more about how it works, but I thought it was pretty cool. So thanks for liking and sharing and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter, and thanks for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command at thebobdavispodcast.com. So in 2018, yes, we're going to be going to some of these districts. I'm going to be going to Texas at some point here, and it's going to be epic. So I'll tell you more about that when we get closer. But thanks for listening, and thanks for your donations. So let's move to the Midwest, starting with Nebraska's 2nd District. This is all the rural areas surrounding Omaha. It is not Omaha, but it's close enough that it can be considered one of these districts where it's conceivable it could be a toss-up. This is a district where Trump only bested Clinton by 2 points here, which is more a little bit more balanced between Republicans and Democrats, as the analysts put it. While the rest, is it the Cornhusker state? Nebraska, I think it is Republican. Incumbent Don Bacon narrowly won the seat in 2016 by 1 point. There are two Democrat candidates, and there will be a primary on May 15th. Bacon currently has a giant fundraising advantage. Brad Ashford is the Democrat frontrunner, a former congressman from the 2nd District. So if he wins the primary, it will be a rematch between these two. Bacon is a vet and retired Air Force general, and he has two postgraduate degrees, one from the Army and one from the Army War College and some other school. And the reason I mention that is he is, while a standard Republican voting with majorities on the tax bill, appropriations, abortion, and so forth, he is no slouch, especially given his military service and his rank. There's nothing unusual here, like in California, where the candidate supports legalization of marijuana or something like that. We don't do that in Nebraska. If you've ever been to Nebraska, you know it is a very – I love Nebraska. It's so interesting because eastern Nebraska is like North Dakota or South Dakota. It's very agricultural. Omaha is a fairly big city, but it's not as big as Minneapolis, right, or Chicago. So – to me, it's kind of a cow town, even though Omaha is actually pretty sophisticated. But when you get into the western part of Nebraska, it's almost like Colorado. So you get into these ranching issues on the western side of the state. On the eastern side of the state, it's very much about agriculture. And I don't know the local issues in Nebraska, but it's kind of got that Platte River, whatever you want to call that river that goes up through South Dakota too. And it's the same situation where South Dakota on the eastern side is very Republican. On the western side, it's more libertarian. And Nebraska is a little bit different in the sense that you have more ranching issues when you get into the western part of the state. I don't know where that comes down politically. The word is that this is a tight race, and a rematch would be interesting because these two have gone at it and one has lost and the other's won before. But the question is whether a rematch would garner more votes for the incumbent this time around, or it would be the reverse. This one is genuinely a toss-up because of the closeness of the votes in the past, but I would say this. Omaha is a little bit more cosmopolitan, but this is certainly not a Democrat stronghold. And I think that calling this as a toss-up is probably a little – it's a genuine toss-up, but it's a very Republican state. Let's move up to Kansas. Kansas has 4 congressional districts. The 2nd district is considered toss-up territory because it is an open seat. The 2nd district is a large district because there's not that many people in Kansas City, but this includes western Kansas City, the metropolitan area on the Kansas side, of course, as well as Topeka, all the way to the northern border and all the way to the southern border. So mostly eastern Kansas. So it borders Nebraska to the north and Oklahoma to the south. Trump won the district by 9 or so points in 2016. The incumbent there, Lynn Jenkins, has said that she will be retiring. And they're viewing this partially because it's an open seat, and secondly because the Public Policy Institute, which is a liberal polling agency, found the Democratic challenger Paul Davis would lead any Republican by 44 to 42%. So right off the bat, this is suddenly a toss-up. Well, it's a Republican district. That is irrefutable. And not only a Republican district, but a Republican district that voted for Trump. The frontrunner, Matt Bevins, only raised something like $8,000. Then he dropped out of the race and endorsed Steve Fitzgerald, who is a state senator in Kansas. More than likely, after the primary, the Democrat candidate will be the Kansas House Minority Leader, Paul Davis. Fitzgerald is a pretty standard Republican candidate and a pretty standard Republican district. The suburban area of western Kansas City is very conservative. Davis ran for governor and was defeated in a rather close election by Sam Brownback. He seems like a pretty standard Democrat in a pretty standard Republican district. Do yourself a favor. Look at a map of this district and think about the geography. West Kansas City and the suburbs at that, and a very rural, very agriculture-oriented, vast prairie that has been Republican for years. Would you call it a toss-up? I don't know if I would. And maybe you'd say, well, Kansas isn't a prairie. Okay, so it's hill country, whatever you want to say. It's rural, okay? Slightly to the east is the Kansas 3rd Congressional District. This includes Overland Park, Kansas City, Kansas, suburban areas of Lenexa, Shawnee, Spring Hill, DeSoto, and Olathe. Maybe a little bit more working class, but pretty high end for Kansas City. Hillary Clinton defeated Donald Trump in this district by 1 point in 2016. Republican incumbent Kevin Yoder won by about 9 points in 2016. And I, again, here's another one that, why is that a toss-up? So Kansas, we'll see. I don't know that I would put either one of those races in a toss-up category. I suppose you could with the open seat, but, you know, we'll just have to see how that goes. Heading up to Iowa, and let me say one other thing real quick before we head up to Iowa. So when you watch political coverage on television, it's all about these national issues. And again, I didn't do it in this thing because it's just too much work. And I don't know that it makes any difference. But every one of these districts has local issues, you know. And you know what I'm talking about. Whatever town you're living in, your congressional district has local issues. And if you're working with anyone or know anyone running for Congress, you know, certainly they're asked about national issues, and certainly when they make some kind of comment about a national issue, it gets headlines locally and sometimes nationally. But what drives these local issues, what drives these races are local issues and personalities. And so without really, you know, I haven't lived in Kansas's 3rd district. I look at these numbers and I see, you know, a largely Republican state or a largely Republican district. And I see somebody, because a liberal institute did a poll that says a Democrat's going to win. Kansas is pretty friggin' conservative. So we'll just, again, I'm watching those and there's no polling. None of the, you know, the Public Policy Institute poll is basically a push poll. They give people information about healthcare and other stuff and energy or whatever, and they're designed to elicit a certain kind of response. I wouldn't take that to the bank. When somebody actually does an objective poll in these states, then we can say it leans this way or it leans that way. If it's a Republican state, how can you say it's a toss-up? That's my issue with all this quote-unquote prediction about, you know, so we've gone through, you know, a little bit more than half of these races, and we've seen already that some of them are not as close as they are said to be. So when we start talking about a wave election, well, not Democrats aren't going to win every one of these races. So it's going to be you know, a mix, and it may not be a mix at all, depending on if there is an overarching national issue that drives Republicans to the polls, right? So let's head up to Iowa, because I don't want to take too much time. Let's talk about the first district in Iowa. I've rolled through here so many times: Dubuque, Cedar Rapids, Waterloo. Trump won this district 49% by 49% of the vote to Clinton's 45 in 2016. In 2016, incumbent Ron Blum defeated Democrat Monica Vernon decisively, 53-46%. Blum has been in Congress since 2014. Iowa is pretty conservative, although Iowa can be kind of purple for various reasons. And don't get me started with the way that they handle presidential elections down there. It's political tourism, and you know, I have my issues with that. The thing is, this district voted for Barack Obama twice, but flipped for Trump in 2016. So we're back to these potentially pivot counties. Iowa has the most number of so-called pivot counties in the U.S. And this is this whole thing that I said when I was traveling and people were all like, Hillary Clinton's going to win. And I said, when you get out of the cities and you see the number of homemade Trump signs in farmers, you know, fields, and you see the Trump signs in the small agricultural towns, you wouldn't say that Hillary Clinton was going to win in a lock, because once you went out and got into the parts of this country that voted for Trump, these pivot counties, you saw that. Once again, Iowa has the largest percentage of pivot counties in the United States. These are counties that flipped from Obama to Trump in one election. Now, there's going to be a primary in this district on the 5th. All three of the top Democrat candidates are running in a statistical tie with Blum. But these were taken last year, these polls, and in January of this year. So we really don't have updated information, and I think we should wait till after the 5th when the primary is over to get an idea of what's happening here in terms of this one gelling. Well, I hope that you understand with this podcast that these are not predictions, but I'm a skeptic about the kinds of predictions that people make about these races until I actually see some hard data, and I think that's a good place to be. But there is one thing that you can make predictions about. When you live in Minnesota, I guarantee you that at some point, it's just getting into May, we're going to see some 70-degree weather, and that means people are going to be turning their AC on. People in Minnesota turn their AC on when it's 65. So let's talk about Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul for home or business, because when it comes to keeping all of your systems running right at home or business, when you have air conditioning problems or you need service, you want reliable service, and that means Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Yes, they go back four generations in Frogtown. Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business, and they can help with AC. You should have the box checked, especially if you're running a business and you have clients. You should have everything checked because debris can get in there and there can be problems, and it might have an effect on efficiency. So have Ryan come out and check your AC before it gets too hot, especially when that thing is working overtime. Just like in the winter, you can lose money because it can be inefficient. The other thing is, if you're building a new garage or a new garage floor or putting in something in your basement and you're going to put a new basement floor in, you should talk to them about in-floor heating. And this is the time when people start thinking about remodeling and getting stuff done before the fall. And Ryan can help you on that front too. Once again, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Ryan Plumbing at ryanplumbing.com. We're going to be talking about Paul Ryan's district, and that, you know, one of the big issues there is going to be NAFTA and trade protection. It's very popular these days, and companies that manufacture overseas, particularly China, have got to start figuring out what they're going to do. And some of these companies are starting to think about bringing their manufacturing back to the U.S. We call it reshoring. If this is you, then let me suggest Depot Star, American Manufacturing, Design, Engineering, and Manufacturing. Visit their website at depotstar.com, D-E-P-O-T-S-T-A-R, depotstar.com. So we're kind of in the home stretch here with all these races. Minnesota is going to be a great political story in 2018, let me tell you. Two open congressional seats, two Senate races, a governor's race. The open House seats include the 1st District, which is way down in the southern part of the state, and the 8th District, which is way up on the Canadian border and covers a huge piece of Minnesota's geography. Minnesota, of course, is a populated state that has a lot of open space, and it's really a giant physical place, and it's deceptive. When you look at Minnesota on a map, it looks kind of small, but let me tell you, Minnesota is very large and quite diverse. The southern part of the state is completely different than the northern part of the state. And the western part of the state is different, and I'll talk about some of that when we talk about the 1st District. The state also has, as I said, two of the races considered toss-ups and very close, and these are real toss-ups. The 2nd District, where first-term incumbent Jason Lewis is facing Angie Craig in a rematch, and of course, Minnesota's 3rd District, where Eric Paulson has been serving for quite some time. A primary June 5th will determine who is the challenger in the 3rd District, although the state Democratic Farm Labor Party has endorsed Dean Phillips, who is heir to the Phillips alcohol fortune, or spirits fortune, and the CEO of the company. Another public policy poll found Phillips in the front by a point or so, too close to call in November of 2017. It's a long time ago. In 2016, Paulson defeated state legislator Terry Bonoff by more than 10 points. Right now, Paulson has the most money, although I would assume Phillips can get as much as he wants. Is it a toss-up? It's not as close as the 2nd, and there's really not much to say about the 2nd except think Lakeville, Minnesota, which is kind of a town in transition that used to be a farm town that's now very much a suburban town, and the fact that the district goes all the way over to Stillwater and Woodbury, which makes it kind of a suburban purple district, so to speak. So that's the 2nd. The 3rd District is really, Eden Prairie, places like that. This is just north of the first district. So it's kind of agricultural, but it's an area of tremendous growth over the last 20 years in the area. Eric Paulson is one of these guys who keeps his head down and does stuff like Hot Dish and talks about they used to call it small ball, but it is an achievement that in this purple district, you have a Republican incumbent who has been serving in Congress since 2009. He's getting the same amount of crap as Jason Lewis is because they refuse to do town hall meetings on guns, and I think they're probably smart to do that. So let's talk about the second district. This is what I would say is the first real and true toss-up race because it's not a purely conservative district. Incumbent Jason Lewis defeated Angie Craig by 1.5 points. Jason Lewis he's a friend of mine. He's a libertarian primarily. He's a little unpredictable in his positions, which I think is good. He had to fight through a tough primary season in 2016. This time, Craig was endorsed by the DFL, but there's going to be a primary on June 5th then, and we will see what the contours of the race will be. More than likely, I guess the DFL has already endorsed Angie Craig, but there's also going to be a primary. So, again, this is both a rural and a suburban district. It's a little more rural than the third district. But it's an interesting place in Minnesota because Minnesota, the southern part of the state, can be Republican, but the Republicans in this state are more like Marco Rubio Republicans. They're very moderate, you know, just like northern Iowa or a place like that. So that's why these are pretty, close races in that sense. One of the two open congressional races in Minnesota this year is the first district, and this is the one that looks most promising for the GOP. Incumbent Tim Walz is retiring from the district that runs along the state's southern border to run for governor. This includes Rochester, Mankato, Winona, Austin, Owatonna, Albert Lea, New Ulm, and Worthington. This is pretty much an agricultural powerhouse, but it also includes the Mayo Clinic, which is the largest employer in the state, HQ'd in Rochester, and Rochester is getting to be like Minneapolis in terms of Republicans and Democrats. It's a kind of a very milquetoast Republican place. They're trying to put in light rail down there. They got $3 billion of subsidies from the state to add on to the Mayo Clinic, blah, 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 blah. It has been a largely Republican district until Tim Penny, whom I would consider a Democrat populist, served as representative from 1983 until 95. He was succeeded by a Republican, Gil Gutnecht, I think that's how you say his name, until Tim Walz was elected in 2007. Tim Walz is hardly a left-wing Democrat, by the way. So in 2016, a guy named Jim Hagedorn, the endorsed GOP candidate in this race, managed to come within 1 point of Walz, who retired then to run for Minnesota governor this year. A recent poll shows him easily defeating his primary opponent to run against Dan Feehan, who was an Obama Defense Department advisor in the general election in the fall. I would say, given Hagedorn's previous performance and the support for Hagedorn down there, this is probably the best hope for a pickup for the Republicans in the state, if not the country. This district voted for Donald Trump by 15 points in 2016, and here we are again with moderately populated rural districts that have gone for Trump, and as a shocking surprise to quote-unquote political observers. So this one could flip. Let's talk about Minnesota's 8th district, which is also an open seat, served by Jim Oberstar, a Democrat congressman. For so long, people forgot this district was represented by the Farmer Labor and Republican Party over the years. Oberstar was preceded by John Blatnick, who also served for almost 30 years. So you had two Democrat congressmen who served for a long time. And then, of course, it flipped back and forth. The current incumbent, Rick Nolan, is retiring. This is where all the taconite mines are. This is where we have this amazing port city, Duluth. There are two or three large Indian reservations, resort towns, and the boundary waters and the Canadian border, and environmental and mining issues are both important. This seemingly Democrat district overwhelmingly voted for Donald Trump in 2016, 54-39%, because of the 8th district, which shocked Democrats. Trump almost took Minnesota. This, as I said, gave the state DFL the shock of their lives because Trump's vote on the range might have given him the state in that election. So when we talk about pivot counties, this district has one or more of those. This is the reason this seat is considered a toss-up. Republican Pete Stabber is going to run unopposed in the primary on August 14th, while as many as five Democrats are going to battle it out in that primary. And so it would still be a toss-up. And probably because of their support for Donald Trump. Things are changing in the 8th District. It used to be a very firm labor, you know, Democrat thing. There are certainly farms. It's very sparsely populated. There are certainly farms in the northern part of the state. Don't get me wrong, but mining for years was the big employer and the population in the range. So Virginia, Eveleth, those people were miners and they had very, and Duluth, and they had very strong union, organization and everything else. So for years it was thought of as a certain way, but not so much anymore. Okay, let's go to Wisconsin. So Wisconsin's first district is Paul Ryan's home district until Ryan announced his retirement from Congress effective January of 2019. This means somebody has to run for that seat. Supposedly the front runner is Paul Nehlen, who seems like a straight up conservative until you get to the part where he agrees with his truck driver potential Democrat opponent, and they're both trade protectionists. Nehlen supports term limits in Washington. Maybe he is why one of Paul Ryan's staffers is running as well. Democrat Randy Bryce, the truck driver guy, has been endorsed by Bernie Sanders. And in my view, you know, there is a whole bunch of just amazing media for this guy, Randy Bryce. So I watched some of his spots and took a look at him, and I don't think he's that great of a candidate. I know it's a rough and tough kind of district. It's a working class kind of district, but, so this is Kenosha basically, and then points west. I don't think Randy Bryce is a very good candidate, especially if they put somebody who knows what they're talking about up. Now, I don't know if Nealon's the guy. I don't have a sense of either one of them, but I did watch Randy Bryce's spots because I was interested in what it was said that he said. Then I watched it and I was like, eh. So we have to wait until the primary August 14th to see what the race is going to look like. Certainly, this is no stranger to populism on the Democrat side, what you would call democratic populism or socialism or socialist populism. You know, this is the home of that. This is an industrial district, and it was a great industrial district as well as a farm district. So this is a place that populism really, this is kind of the birthplace of populism in this country. And by the way, kind of the birthplace of socialism, industrial socialism in America. So we're going to have to wait till the primary August 14th to see what this is going to look like. Again, no polling, but we're going to tell everybody this is a toss-up race. Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton here 53-42% in 2016. Obviously, it's Paul Ryan's district. You could say it's a Democrat pickup, but I don't see why they call it a toss-up. So we're going to move to Illinois. This is the 6th district, considered a toss-up. And again, I'm shaking my head. Here the incumbent is Peter Roskam, who has been in office since 2007. One of the themes in this midterm with Democrats is watch out, Republicans, because the scientists are coming with all your crap about global warming and health care. We have a cadre of, quote, science-based candidates who are going to put Republicans to the test. In Illinois 6th, a first-time candidate and former energy executive decries the president and Roskam's energy and health care policies. But here's the thing. Peter Roskam is no slouch. He has a JD in law, Illinois Assembly experience. He was an assistant to Henry Hyde, who is famously from, you know, one of Illinois' only Republicans back in the day, fourth-ranking Republican in the House. And it is a district that voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. But at the same time, Roskam defeated Democrat Amanda Hallin by just shy of 20 points. So how is this suddenly a toss-up? Because why? Well, I'm from Illinois and I'm from Chicago, and I can tell you this includes Hoffman Estates. We used to get high and drive around Hoffman Estates and pretend it was a special world that was built for rich people. That's what Hoffman Estates is like. A number of high-income suburbs, not dissimilar to California's Orange County. Calling this a toss-up is a presumption beyond presumptions, to tell you the truth. Given Illinois' financial problems, it's a hospitable environment, I think, for Republicans, especially in a wealthy north suburban area. I understand that in a lot of those north suburban areas, you know, they get guilty and they start voting for Democrats, but I'm not buying that that's a toss-up. You never know. And then we come to Illinois' 12th district. At the southwestern tip of the state, another quote-unquote toss-up. This includes diverse places like East St. Louis, Carbondale, and Cahokia. I used to live there as well. Cahokia is very much working class. Carbondale, of course, is where Southern Illinois University is. On the Illinois side, by St. Louis and Belleville, these are working-class neighborhoods. All the way down to the southwestern tip of the state on the border with Kentucky and northeast from Carbondale to the Shawnee National Forest. This is a vast and diverse demographic area as well as geographic area. The truth is it's largely agricultural with small and relatively large small towns, more like the South than the Midwest, although Illinois is the land of Lincoln and Obama. The incumbent in this race is Mike Bost, who has been serving in Congress since 2014. Interesting thing about this race is the fact that Brendan Kelly, the Democrat, has already said he could not support Nancy Pelosi as leader. Both candidates are vets. Bost served as a Marine. Kelly was a Navy, helicopter pilot. Bost has also been a firefighter, worked at Bost Trucking for a number of years. Again, pretty working class, both pretty normal everyday Illinois guys. Here's the thing. Bost garnered 54% of the vote in 2016, 15 points ahead of his nearest challenger. Trump won the district by 15 points. Bost has raised over $1 million so far, and while the Democrat is raising a fair amount too, again, I can't see why this, especially in Southern Illinois, which is may as well be Kentucky and very conservative, I don't see how you could consider this a toss-up race at all. So let's move on and quickly to Michigan. This is the 11th district in Michigan, which some analysts say covers, quote-unquote, the Detroit area. It's an open seat, and this is why it's considered a toss-up. This is a horseshoe-shaped district in suburban Detroit, so we're talking about Westland, Livonia, Highland, and White Lake Townships, West Bloomfield, etc. Suburban Pontiac, Michigan, 82% white to the north, and then on the eastern side, the right side, is Detroit, but it doesn't include Detroit. And this is a district that Trump took by 50 to 45% in 2016, solidly Republican in its various incarnations. If you know anything about Detroit, you know that Detroit is the hole in the donut. The donut around Detroit is actually pretty affluent. And so the most recent redistricting took parts of the Upper Peninsula away from the 12th district, and now the new 12th is mostly the old 18th district. So this is actually a little more Republican than it was. Incumbent David Trott is retiring, so that's why they call it an open seat. It's close enough as an open – it's close enough that you could probably say that it's an open seat. But again, I'm looking at the demographics of this part of Michigan. Here again, the Public Policy Institute, these are the only people doing any polling, and they did a poll last year showing that a hypothetical Republican candidate running against a hypothetical Democrat showed the Democrat winning by 5 points. And this is the one that also include unspecified information about the tax bill and health care initiatives. So it's a push poll, basically. Just because it's on the list of potential targets for the Democrats does not make this a toss-up, particularly when you consider the demographics and sociographics of the area. There will be a primary to serve on August 7th to decide which candidates are going to be chosen on both sides, and then we'll see what's going on. And actually, I don't even need to go through the challengers because the primary is going to tell the whole story. Let's go to Georgia and talk about the 6th District. This is Newt Gingrich's old district. He served there as a member from 79 to 99. It certainly isn't what it was back in those days because it's become a little bit more cosmopolitan. Donald Trump won a thin victory in Georgia in 2016, winning this supposedly solid Republican district by 1%. The incumbent, Karen Handel, won by 4 points in a special election in 2017 after Tom Price retired. This race was one of the first races the Democrats poured resources into in an effort to quote-unquote build infrastructure for 2018, as I am sure they will do again. There are four Democrats running in a primary election May 22nd. Handel is running unopposed on the Republican side. Again, I think the closeness of the margins on the presidential side as well as the congressional side makes this race suggestively competitive. I don't think you can say it leads Republican just because of those margins, but when you consider the resources the Democrats dumped into this race in 2017 and still didn't win, it has shades of the Arizona 8th. Everyone said would go to the Democrats because they were spending so much money and it didn't. Is it a toss-up? Well, It's because it's a close margin that it's a toss-up. So again, no polls here, no predictions, and predictions are dangerous. No matter who the Democrats put to run against Handel, it's still going to be a close race. What's unique about this one is there is a general election on November 6th and a runoff election already scheduled for December. About a month later, Georgia has a two-round system, so there is a runoff if one candidate does not win a clear majority. So that one won't be decided on election night. What can I tell you about Pennsylvania? On February 19th, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court adopted a new congressional district map after ruling that the original map constituted an illegal partisan gerrymander. This has completely screwed up Pennsylvania. The districts in flux are basically all of them, but the first, the 10th, and one of the most famous special elections in a while was this spring's fight between Rick Saccone and Connor Lamb. Both are going to have to run again in November in new districts. So that's what's wrong with Pennsylvania. And again, how can you project winners, losers? These are all new districts. It's ridiculous, and it's completely screwed up. You can't even tell who's running where at this point. Let's talk about New York real quick because I'm getting to the end here. Let's talk about New York's 19th in the Catskills. This is a district Trump took by 6 points in 2016, extends south from Arlington and Port Jervis to Rockland and Westmoreland counties in the New York Metro. These are the rich counties in the northern part of the New York Metro. It's been Republican since 2011. The incumbent is John Faso. Faso won in 2016 by 9 points, another district with a Republican incumbent running in a June primary unopposed and several Democrat candidates battling it out. Rather than go through all the Democrats, we should wonder again whether the plethora of Democrat candidates ends up splintering the Democrat vote for the general election. Yes, I'm reading this. I wrote it, though. This is a pretty solidly Republican district, so we will have to wait for the polls and who the candidates will actually be that will challenge Faso. A 9-point lead in the presidential race in a district that voted for Barack Obama and a 9-point lead for the incumbent makes me wonder why they would put this up into the toss-up column. Faso is a little light on money raised, while some of the Democrats have a lot more cash on hand. But if the Democrats are pouring money into the race, maybe the Republicans are holding back until they see what's actually going to go down. Faso has been tainted by the Cambridge Analytical scandal, but he still defends them, and he has been in trouble a little bit with the anti-gun people. But I don't see how the gun control thing in this part of New York hurts this guy. He's also pushing back on NAFTA, which actually helps. So let's talk about New York's 22nd district. This is in the central part of the state, Oneida, home to a number of universities. Represented by Democrats for years, the district has shifted to Republicans since 1983, except for 10 years from 2003 and 2013. I mention this because there's a bit of a swing going on there, which is one of the reasons they could consider this a toss-up, or the Democrats could consider it an opportunity for pickup. Claudia Tenney is a first-term incumbent, taking office in January 2017 as part of the 115th Congress, and she will have to run again. This is a new district and considerably different from the old district since 2013, which is perhaps one of the reasons Republicans have been running a little better here. New York's 22nd intersects with more than one of those so-called pivot counties. So again, we're back to making wild predictions about things. Syracuse is one of the pivot counties. Tenney won in 2016 by almost 6 points. There's a primary June 26 to decide the Democrat challenger. Again, Trump did really well in some of these counties in 2016. We're going to have to wait to see what happens, and there are no polls yet. New Hampshire's first district. It's an open seat. The first congressional district covers the southeastern part of New Hampshire. I have never been there. It is viewed as a +2 Republican district. Trump eked out a victory here by 1 point. The incumbent, Carol Shea Porter, won by 1% as well. There are 8 Democrat candidates vying in the primary race. Again, a lot of these races where there's a ton of Democrat candidates makes me wonder whether they're just going to cancel each other out. It's almost, and by the way, the DCCC is really coming down on these candidates because they want them to withdraw because they see this as a problem too. But we're really close to the primary season now. So I don't know what's going to happen. Let's move to New Jersey's 7th. This is suburban Newark, but not the bad part of Newark. So this is Essex, Morris, Somerset, and Union counties, kind of like Roscom's district in Illinois, although there's nothing wrong with Newark proper, which has really been going through some renewal over the years. We're talking about the Short Hills and Millburn, an ethnically diverse part of New Jersey, but high income. So when we talk about blacks in this part of New Jersey, we're talking perhaps about high income, black people or high income Hispanic people, all the way to the western part of the state, very rural and farm country. And in 2016, Republican incumbent Leonard Lance garnered 54% of the vote to his opponent's 43%. That is hardly a close race. Yes, Clinton took the district by 2 points in 2016. I mentioned the racial issue. It has been Republican since 1981. They're going to have a primary June 5th, and we're just going to have to see. Lance endorsed Chris Christie. Not such a bad thing in New Jersey. We're going to have to see what happens. Finally, there are districts which are open seats the analysts have as leaning Democrats or toss-up. I'm going to talk about some of these very quickly. You have to be careful with these kinds of characterizations, especially before a primary. There are enough of these districts in the country that this is actually the source of the storyline, that it's going to be a wave election, because if they lose all these races, these are almost all Republican districts, if they lose all these races, then you're going to have a completely different kind of problem. So I wouldn't take a side. So Arizona 2nd, Martha McSally is retiring to run for the Senate. But this is Cochise County, Arizona, a Democrat pickup because Clinton won by 5 points. Come on. Is this an open seat? And that's why I've been down there. This is not a Democrat territory. They've got a former representative running who was raised on the Apache Reservation, which is actually the coolest and best reservation I've seen in the country, and a former member of the Arizona House of Representatives. They have this as a lean Democrat district because there is no worthy Republican candidate at this point who has hardly raised any money, so this is why. It's a toss-up. California's 39th includes Orange County, Los Angeles, Yorba Linda. It's represented by Ed Royce, a former Republican stronghold. Redistricting, Ed Royce represented this district for years before Linda Sanchez won 4 terms in a row. Ed Royce got the seat back in 2012 and has served since. Very quickly, this is another open seat in a district where Republicans used to win by wide margins, but which voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. But this is a local race, and this is not exactly Democrat territory. Another California race, 49th district. It's coastline just north of La Jolla to Dana Point in inland, including Camp Pendleton with a leg east almost to Escondido, part of Orange County and western San Diego County. It's an open seat because Darrell Issa, the incumbent, is now retiring. Issa won in 2016 by a thin margin. Here again, large number of candidates, this time Republican. Again, the DCCC is very concerned about this number of Democrat candidates canceling each other out because California has the top two rule, which could cancel the Democrat entirely if there's too many running. You have the same thing going on in Florida as you do in Pennsylvania, by the way. The Florida Supreme Court basically redrew some of these key districts after a lawsuit in 2015, so it's hard to tell what's going on. They've got Florida's 26th as a toss-up and an open seat, I guess, or something to that effect. It runs from West Miami down through the Everglades and the Keys. Hillary Clinton won the district 56-40. This is probably very much along ethnic lines. It's more Republican than Democrat. And of course, we all know the Keys are almost unpredictable, very liberal, actually libertarian. And I could go through all those, but we have to wait and see what the actual primary ends up with. Florida's 27th is also on this list. Elena Ross, the incumbent, is retiring. This is South Miami down to Kendall, and there are a ton of candidates running in the primary in August, lots of Democrats. This is a district that supported Clinton by almost 20 points. Here again, the Democrats are targeting this district. Here's another public policy poll. It's the only one that shows a generic Democrat candidate beating the generic Republican by 20 points, which I could have told you by simply looking at Hillary Clinton's vote tallies. The New York Times calls this the best pickup opportunity for the Democrats in the country, and we'll just give it to them until we see, you know, what happens on election night. There's no reason to revisit that one. I mentioned New Jersey's 2nd, or did I? The southern tip of New Jersey from Camden to Gloucester all the way over to the coast, including Atlantic City, all the way down to Cape May to the Delaware Bay. This is a beautiful part of the state. This is a district that Trump won by 5 points in 2016, another district which has been redistricted, and the Republican incumbent Frank Lobiondo is retiring. Another situation where the DCCC is saying this is one of their targets, and on cue, everyone says it's a toss-up. So then all of the analysts say that it leans Democrat. I don't know. You know, it's hard to tell. Finally, one last one, and this is the 11th Congressional District. This is also an open seat. It used to be Democrat until the 80s. It's Morris County, suburban settlements around New York City and Newark. And also includes the Ramapo Mountains and some pretty rural parts of New Jersey. Virginia's 10th is another one. This is a U.S. congressional district in the Commonwealth of Virginia. The 10th district is up in northwestern Virginia. Barbara Comstock is running there as the Republican. This includes all of Clark, Frederick, and Loudoun, and the independent cities of Manassas, Manassas Park, and Winchester, along with portions of Fairfax and Prince William counties. I would say in Northern Virginia, this is the more conservative of the districts. The closer you get to Washington, then you get into different makeups, which, by the way, also can change depending on who is president. Basically, Western North Virginia to the West Virginia border. Clinton took the district by 10 points in 2016. Barbara Jean Comstock, the incumbent, won her race by about 5 points. Here again, the incumbent has a lot of fundraising capabilities. I think she's probably raised more money than any of the other potential candidates. The Democrat is no shoo-in in this district. So that is, and I'm going to have to go because now I'm way over my time limit, but you know, that is the complete toss-up, number of toss-up races. So the key points are sometimes they call these toss-ups and they're not. The other thing is that the reason that they're talking about a Democrat wave is that there are so many Republican seats in the toss-up category and the redistricting in Pennsylvania and the potential that if the Democrats were to take some of those key seats that I have mentioned that are, you know, very largely being defended by Republicans, then you would see them potentially overtaking the Republicans in the House. So it is possible for Republicans to lose the House despite whatever happens in the Senate, just because of the things I've explained. It's not probable. It depends on the outcome in the primaries. It depends on the tactical situation on the ground in a lot of these districts. But now you've seen the whole picture. So when I go down to Texas, I can talk about that. When I go to Iowa, I can talk about it. When I go to northern Minnesota, I can talk about it in relation to this podcast. And I am exhausted because I spent the last 2 days going through every if I have to look up another congressional district, I'm going to scream. Okay. Boy, I'm exhausted after all that. But I will tell you, once it gets over 70 degrees, people in Minnesota start turning their AC on. Actually, they'll turn it on at 65, and you don't know if you have any problems because you've had it off for 8 months. Think about Ryan Plumbing and Heating for home or business, coming out and checking your AC before it is hot and before it is working overtime to make sure it's working right and to make sure the filters are set up and everything else. Reliable service for your AC. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488 online at ryanplumbing.com. So thanks for listening to podcast 717. You know, I know these are long, and I know that they're very political. I find it fascinating just because of the data. This is what I do. And if you're a political freak, I imagine that you do too. So I welcome any thoughts that you might have by email. I appreciate you listening to podcast 717, the Bob Davis Podcasts. No more politics for the next couple of podcasts. Bye-bye.